Accession number 18335, Reel 3.
Mr. Lakeman, Reel 3.
Yes, and on the map I was given on board the boat, they actually put a mark in this orchard where they wanted me to park my truck. The only latitude I was allowed was I could put in a position which would give me a chance of better communications. But of course, everything had to be camouflaged with nets and what have you. But I actually landed right on the spot where they asked me to go. And I thought that was a wonderful organization on behalf of the Army. And apparently, after the war, it came out that they made use of photographs and postcards of people that holidayed in the area, and secret agents who'd send information back, so that it was such a detailed knowledge of the area that we were able to take full advantage of it. Marvelous. And that's where we ended up in the first night.
Did you experience anything in the way of enemy fire?
Yes, but I must say, going in, we were extremely fortunate. Juneau Beach, as you know, was reputed to be one of the worst after Omaha. And you could see from the debris and all the problems as we went in, how bloody it had been. But the actual 3 or 4 minutes run in, which we had, I know we were fully occupied in what we had to do on the sets, but it was comparatively quiet. And I often say, and I don't think people believe me sometimes, that some of the training we had in Scotland and in South Wales, landing on the beaches there in preparation for D-Day, with live fire, was, if anything, more intimidating, more frightening than the real thing, as far as I was concerned. I was bloody lucky, no two ways about that, for which I thank God. We got in over the beaches, and Fred immediately took all the waterproofing off his vehicle at the very first opportunity when we got off the beach. And I know the first instance I had was something came over, a Monin Mini came over, and I dived into a sand dune by the side, and I felt very humble because there was a padre there giving last rites to a poor fellow who was obviously dying. His face was blue, and he didn't have long to go. So I soon got myself out of that position and back in action again. But, yeah, you were grateful. And as I said, we got up into this orchard, and there was still sniping and things going on, but the Canadians ahead of us, they'd done a fantastic job. And, of course, some of those regiments, the Chaudiers and the Royal Winnipeg Rifles, and those lads had made the biggest inroad on D-Day. I think they got about 14 miles inland on the first day, which was the best beachhead of all. They had to come back a bit afterwards, but incredible, those Canadians. I'm proud to have been a part of them.
And then?
Well, then, of course, we settled in, and you were so busy sending all these messages on the sets, running lines out to the various engineer sections, you know, that you were kept so busy, you didn't have much time to think. I suppose deep down we were all worried, all afraid, but having such a job to do and knowing it was an important job, kept you going.
Did your work go smoothly, or were there any problems in Normandy?
There was often problems, especially with the engineers, you know. They would lay track down, they'd lay bridges down, and they'd be damaged or blown up, and they had to redo them. And there was all sorts of, as you know, counterattacks by the Panzer divisions, which were opposite you. And all sorts of rumors were flying around. The one thing I do vividly remember was about 4 days after D-Day, one of my lads, this Andrew, funnily enough, he got shot. We don't quite know how, why, or where. It's a sniper's bullet. But he lost an eye. And I struggled with him to the nearest post, you know, medical post. And as they took him away to the hospital, a corporal came up to me, an infantryman, and he said, "Corpse," he said, "I was a corporal then." He said, "There's, you won't believe this," he said, "but there's a Nazi hut down there." I said, "Nazi?" "Yes," he said, "dishing out tea." Couldn't believe it. My first reaction was, I must get back to my vehicle, having got rid of this wounded fellow. But this intrigued me, and I just walked to the end of this lane, and there was this vehicle. It wasn't a Nazi. It was a Salvation Army. And there was these two old boys in their 60s, old boys, 60s, and one of them had a flat hat on, and another one had a jaunty bowler on. And they were First World War men doing, dishing out tea, and that for the troops. And there was a small queue, 7 or 8 people there, queuing up with their mess tins for tea. And I didn't have a mess tin, because, as I said, I just got rid of Andrews. And this corporal said to me, "Here, mate, I've had my tea, take this." And I took his mess tin and thanked him, filled it up with tea. And I said, "You want your mess tin?" "No," he said, "I'll get another one." And somebody came up to him and said, "Corporal Mac something," and I can never remember what it was. He wasn't a Scotsman, and it was an unusual Scottish name. "Are you Corporal Mac something or other? And have you got the flail? You know, the flail tank?" "Yes," he said. "Right away," he said, "you're wanted." And he dashed away up the road. And as I went back with this tin of tea, mess tin of tea, a minute or two later, I hear the tanks starting up and everything. There was this terrific explosion. I got the tea back to the lads, told them what happened. They wouldn't believe me, and I thought, "Well, what the hell did you get this sort of business?" And one of our dispatch riders came in. I said, "What was that explosion?" "Oh," he said, "some poor devil," he said, "in a flail tank." He said he went over a really big one. Now, just up the road was a German radar signal station at a place called Bali, near Douvres. And we were told that this was of prime importance. And it was hoped that the British Army or the Canadians would capture this on the first day with as much information intact inside. We know that the RAF bombed it, the Navy shelled it, the commando stormed it, and they didn't yield an inch. It was underground. And for 14 days or more, they held out. We bypassed it eventually and moved up further towards what is now known as Pegasus Bridge, up through past Ranville, that way. When British Corps headquarters were at Ranville, or near there, but we moved up past them with the Canadians and nearer to Caen, Carpique. And as we moved up there, there was all sorts of infiltrations, little pockets going. And there was a big push, as you probably know about. I've lost the trend a bit now. But Yes, there was lots of activity both sides, but the main thing was we had supreme control in the air. There was no harassments of anything to worry about from the Luftwaffe, which surprised us greatly. The Germans did have lots of attacks with their panzers and that, which caused a lot of problems for the lads right at the front. And the thing that really worried us all was when that storm came up, 6 or 7 days after D-Day, and everything was blown to pieces and raining and wet, and no supplies could get forward, and everybody was very short of both ammunition and food and supplies generally. That was very worrying, and we all knew about it too. But we survived. We survived.
How was Brigadier Campbell coping with it all?
Wonderfully well. I don't think that man slept more than 5 or 6 hours a day. And he snatched sleep when he could. And he's always on top of it all. And his staff officers, when they came around, they were superb too. They had complete control. And they kept us in the picture of what we were trying to do, which I thought was great. You felt you wanted to be part and parcel of them, which we were, of course. And
were you a sergeant?
No, not until later. No, I really, I didn't exactly refuse promotion, but I preferred to stay with my section as the corporal in charge of the Royal Engineers, then move on as a section sergeant at that time.
What contact did you have with the Norman civilians?
Very little, because we were so busily, heavily involved on the sets. You see, 24 hours a day, very demanding. And just occasionally you'd talk to some of the civilians, especially if, as you move forward, and perhaps you'd stop at a farm. I know once we managed to barter for some eggs, which were pretty scarce, but we did manage a few of those. And I think we exchanged some bully beef or something for a bottle of wine.
No,
they were generally fairly friendly. Bewildered, I think, was what I would sum them up as.
Now you'd finally got into contact with the enemy, what did you think of them?
Oh, they're very good soldiers, no two ways about it. I saw a lot of the Wehrmacht, the youth that they trained to come up, the boy soldiers. They seemed to have a lot of lads there, 17, 16, you know. And a lot of much older men in their 50s and 60s, who'd been drafted into what I suppose they thought was a safe haven, Normandy and Brittany and that part of the coast, you know, compared with the Russian front. They probably thought they were on a pretty good posting. But they certainly they were good fighters. But the creme, of course, were the panzer divisions and the German infantry divisions, which really were formidable. Full of admiration, you couldn't help it. I mean, this Douvres radio station, they hung out for all that time. We bypassed them. We were told to move on. But I understand that when they eventually capitulated, it was mainly because the air and the water was so foul underneath they couldn't stick it any longer. They'd survived all the bombardment, all the bombing and everything else. They even sent the flamethrowers in to try and, you know, get them out. They came out, they looked like death warmed up. Now, apparently they were almost saying snobbish, but they were a better class, better type of soldier than the usual Wehrmacht were Germans. And of course they'd been in the area for, 4 years. So a lot of them were known by sight, if not personally, by the local population, who said that they never showed any signs of any bestiality or brutality or no question of raping women or anything like that. They behaved as conquerors, should. But he said some of them even clapped in a way to say, well, you know, what a fantastic job you've done. Now, that's what I've been told by people that live in Douvres today. They were glad to see the back of them, that they'd been defeated, but they couldn't help but show their admiration for them. And I mean, when I think of it, I feel, you know, they did a damn good job for their country. Got to be fair. I expect we would have done the same. But apparently they used a lot of this silver foil and paper and disrupted all the radio communications of the Allies. And they reckon that they did untold damage to our cause, both before and during the invasion. And they've opened a special museum there quite recently, within the last 2 years, which I must go over and see. At the Douvres radio, German radio station.
How did they use the foil to do that?
Don't ask me how it was done, but they had all this way of blocking out all the signals. Fantastic.
What other memories have you got of Normandy?
Hard going. Very hot. I should never ever forget the smell and the stench around Falaise. Of death. All the animals, cows and what have you, the destruction. We didn't go into Caen as such, although I remember the 1,000 bomber raid well. We were underneath that, and the drone was perpetual. And they were going well away to us, over. And I was thinking, God, who's ever's under that will know all about it. And I did have one, if you like, amusing experience. One of these planes, it turned out to be an American, had been shot down, and fortunately all the people seemed to get out all right. And we could see this parachute come floating down. And he got tangled up in a tree quite near us. And I happened to be off the set at the time. And I went over with a machete to help him down. And this American voice said, gee, thank God, he said. We thought you were Nazi. We couldn't see your sign because we were very well camouflaged. We had camouflage. As soon as we stopped anywhere, the green camouflage nets would come over first thing. Sometimes it was a damn nuisance because we'd stop, put the nets out, which took about 3 or 4 minutes, and then you move on again. And up they come, and down they go again, you know. But this fellow came down, and first thing he did was he lit up a cheroot. And I said, are you all right? And he laughed, and he said, yeah, but he said, I shit myself. I always remember that. And just then, a jeep came up, and an officer came in, they collected him, took him back. But he said he thought all his buddies had got out. They'd been hit and they'd come down. He said, it was some raid, buddy. And I agree with him. I think it was about, that was one of the 1,000 bomber raids. But anyway, he was all right. Quite a jovial little chap. Shook my hand warmly, and I think he thought he landed amongst the Germans.
Now, when it came to the breakout, what happened to you then?
Funnily enough, I take over our section sergeant, a fellow called Thompson, and he'd come off and broken his leg. And I was doing part-time duties for him. And on one occasion, I was going to the various detachments, visiting them, and amongst other things, we were getting mail coming in then. And delivering the mail and one or two things, and checking up on everything and everybody's supplies and stores. And for some reason, I collapsed. At first, they thought when they picked me up, I hadn't been feeling very well, and I'd had the runs, diarrhea. And they said, oh, a bit of battle exhaustion or a bit of dysentery or something. I can't remember anything about it. I came off this bike, which was all right, motorbike, and I woke up in this field hospital. And they said, oh, you're all right. You've very badly bruised your arm and your leg, but nothing serious. You haven't been hit at all. They said, you're just absolutely unconscious when you were picked up. Flaked out. And I was in an awful mess generally. And they said, we're keeping you here for a day. They gave me all sorts of tablets. I don't know what they were. So I remember sleeping. We were terribly tired. I remember going to sleep after that. And waking up, and I could hear all this gunfire. And the Falaise battle had started, which was quite nearby. And I said, I want to get back to the unit. They said, you mustn't leave here without permission. Anyway, I badgered them so much that I was able to go. And eventually, they said, well, if you can find a unit that's going forward, we'll let you go. So I signed a paper to that effect. And I saw one of the corps vehicles moving up, you know. I went with them, went with it. And I was feeling terribly weak. And when I got back to the truck, to the vehicle, they were all glad to see me because they wondered what happened to me, you know. The motorbike had been returned, believe it or not, that they'd found. And my crew said, how lucky you are. You're one of the few fellows that got a parcel, the first parcels that arrived from the UK. And they had a little parcel from my mother. And of course, we all had visions of cake and sharing a cake. And I unpacked it. And here we were in a Normandy orchard, surrounded by apples. And my mother had sent, amongst other things, some apples. Of course, we thought that was a hell of a good laugh. But there was razor blades and one or two things like that, which were gratefully received. But you never forget that. And poor mother never lived it down. That was the first parcels that came over. And, as I say, apples to Normandy, coals to Newcastle. But then the next thing we were on, we cut right across then with the engineers up to Le Havre for the liberation of Le Havre. And that too, there was a lot of bombing went on there by the RAF, which events have proved would be unnecessary because the Germans had virtually capitulated. But we didn't know that. And I must confess, I made a boob there, sitting in front with the driver going up at night. And of course, there's no lights, you're very restricted, and still a lot of activity in the air, lots of fires going on in Le Havre. And we got into the side of the road, into Acton Minen, in the minefield. So I told Mincher, I said, stop. For Christ's sake, stop. We're in there. The only thing I could do was get out and go into it and back him out carefully. And we did that without any other problems. And then as we got into Le Havre, I always remember some civilians coming up with some German prisoners. Well, we didn't have the facilities, didn't want to be bothered with the prisoners. So I remember taking charge of two of them and handing them over to some infantrymen who were nearby. Which they said, we don't want them, you're going to have them. And we eventually got into Le Havre. Of course, the place had capitulated then. And for a time, I was a proud owner of a miniature replica of the Blue Ribbon Line, because we're down on the docks, and the Normandy liner, La France and Normandy, had broken the Blue Ribbon of the Atlantic just prior to the war, And they'd won the Blue Ribbon of the Atlantic before. I think the QE2 regained it, didn't it? One of the English boats, I think. But there was all the what remained of the offices, because they were badly damaged and burned, with all the photographs of the Champlain and the Normandy and La France, all the liners going around the walls, the boardroom. And that was my little souvenir.
What condition were the German prisoners in?
Relieved, I think, that it was all over. Again, there were coastal defences and a mixture of very young and very old. They weren't the crack German troops. The people that showed all the, if you like, aggression and soldiermanship as the panzer troops, the airborne troops, and the crack regiments, you know.
What was the attitude of civilians in Le Havre towards you?
They were delighted to see us, I'm sure, but they couldn't understand why we continued the bombing and shelling when the Germans had retreated from the town. But our army HQ eventually said we didn't know that. They said that our information wasn't too good. But past events have proved that thousands of civilians have suffered unnecessarily. And I believe even to this day when they have reunions about the liberation of Le Havre, there's a little bit of bitterness about this. I've only heard this. I don't know. I've never experienced it myself. But there must be.
What happened to you after this?
Well, we gradually made our way up then, or really rapidly then, up through into Belgium, across the River Seine into Belgium. And, of course, the Royal Engineer signal section were always busy because there was always little bridges to be built and roads to be widened and things like that. I know earlier on in Normandy, I'd come across again a thing I wasn't prepared for. A vast hold-up on a road. And I got out to see why we were being held up. And a lorry had overturned completely with stores on it and was blocking the narrow roads. And this officer came to me and said, I order you and your men to come and give a hand. So I said, well, we must keep this man on the set, you know. But we will come and do what we could. And when we went to this lorry and put the sheets back, what he had in there was bodies, which were wrapped up in a blanket. And I remember we put these bodies, which were just loosely tied up, on the side of the road. And he explained that the Pioneer Corps or somebody would come along and give them a burial, you know. And then a recovery truck of, I'm not sure whether it's REMI or RAOC, came along and with a crane and lifted this thing up. And the traffic was able to get through. In fact, before that had happened, the engineers came up and with some equipment, they cut a sway through the fence so we were going around in the field so that the traffic...